KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's a pleasure to have my guest producer, Christine Vachon, here today because we've had so many of the directors that she's worked with. We're here talking about her new book, her second book, A Killer Life, and I'm going to read something from the foreword by John Pearson to help give you some idea of who she is. John Waters, John Cameron Mitchell, Mark Romanek, Larry Clark, Robert Altman, Julian Schnabel, David Gordon Green, Doug McGrath, Kim Pierce, Mary Harron, twice, Todd Solondz, twice, Rose Trochet, twice, Todd Haynes, five times, are just some of the directors with whom she's collaborated. They've been gay or straight, or bi, or undeclared. They've been young and old. There's been a notable willingness to work with first-time filmmakers, but there's also a place for a 30th-timer like Robert Altman. In one of the richest ongoing producer-director relationships in contemporary film, Christine is to independent film's greatest visual stylist, Todd Haynes, as Ross Hunter was to Douglas Sirk. Now, Christine hasn't produced Airport, but she has produced movies that include I Shot Andy Warhol, Far From Heaven, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, a great short we were just talking about before we got going called He Was Once. Christine, thanks so much for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's interesting because I think of the title Far From Heaven as being basically a description of your aesthetic as a producer.
You mean too many feel-bad movies?
Well, you say in yourself, you kind of allow that you would be more interested in the dark side. You wear all black, so nobody confuses you with the brighter side of
Absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely. But now it's become a uniform, you know. I mean, definitely, look, we don't – it's all about a movie that strikes us as being original or provocative or really just a story that we haven't seen told before. And, yes, sometimes those stories take us to the dark side. But we often find, you know, we were just talking about I Shot Andy Warhol, and that movie, I think, is in its own strange way, really, it's not dark. It's about how this woman managed to find something, even though she was, you know, that crazy, and that that her legacy actually still lives on.
Yeah, but she did shoot Andy Warhol.
She did.
I guess so. You talk about though. In the book, the films you saw as a youngster here in New York, and what really influenced you in those films and clearly has led to your work as a producer, are films with a very specific point of view.
Oh, absolutely. And I was very lucky because the New York I grew up in still had so many repertory movie theaters. You know, we could walk ourselves to the Thalia or to the old Metro or to the Olympia, just to theaters where they would just play Fassbinder films. And because my mother was French, she missed hearing her language. So she dragged me to every French film that came to New York.
Because so many of the films you talk about seeing as a kid, they're about what a lot of these films that you produce are about, which is not knowing where you are narratively for, I would say, in many of these cases, the first third of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly that kind of storytelling or filmmaking interests you, doesn't it?
Well, it does. But don't you think there's also something, and I don't know, I'm trying to think the last time I had this experience. When you go into a movie and you sit down and in the first minute or two, you feel just this sense of safety that you are in somebody's very sure hands. And that doesn't happen. I mean, it doesn't happen when you go see The Wedding Crashers or, you know what I mean? It happens really when you go to see a movie that you give yourself over to it. You say, I'm going to go. I'm going to go wherever this guy or this woman takes me because I trust. There's such a directorial touch here.
We're talking to Christine Vachon. Her new book is A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. I guess for me, these films, and you talk about how Swoon got going in the book and Poison and Go Fish. And these were films that to some extent kind of found themselves in the making, but still end up being these films that I think of as being killer films.
Oh, absolutely. But the thing about to look back at like Swoon or Poison historically to a certain degree, the fact is, and I know a lot's been made of like, you know, the so-called new queer cinema or what have you, but in pure pragmatic terms, those movies both came out at a time when there were no gay movies. So the interesting thing to me about Poison and to a certain extent Go Fish too, is those films are both so experimental and so many people went to see them who wouldn't have gone to see such experimental films simply because they heard there was some gay content.
I guess I would ask you as a producer how conscious you are at this point now, given the number of films you've made, of films filling a kind of void because it just sort of happened with these films we're talking about, that first wave of gay cinema in the 90s, that there was a need for those, a hunger for those. And is that part of the way you work in some way or another, do you think?
Not consciously, but I think that it goes part and parcel with what I said about trying to find stories that haven't been told before, because obviously those are the ones, you know, from, I wouldn't go so far as to say the disenfranchised, but people who don't get a voice. I mean, that's the other thing, too, about first-time directors is their films tend to be the films they've spent their whole lives trying to make. So they are that kind of passion can be exciting and fun. You know, it can also be, you know, it can also be exhausting, but it helps give those movies a sense of immediacy and urgency.
That sense still sort of exists, though. We're talking about Todd Haynes, I think there's an enormous amount of urgency and immediacy in Velvet Goldmine, which is actually my favorite of all of his films.
I think, it might be mine, too.
I think that movie released now actually would have a lot more currency than it had at the time.
Well, Todd always is ahead of the curve. But I think Velvet Goldmine, in some ways, it is the most perfect movie about being a fan. About being a fan in any sense of the word. About loving something, whether it's movies or music. In this case, it's in Velvet Goldmine's case, it's music. But it takes you so back to that place of just that passion. And it's a wonderful place to be for 2 hours.
We should say this movie is set in the London of the 70s. And I think it's the first time anybody really romanticized the 70s and that music in a movie, because the 70s was still the butt of a joke. And also that period of 70s music really hadn't been rediscovered yet. I mean,
right.
You had groups like Suede who really hadn't quite caught on yet or looked upon as kind of a joke. And that romanticism that's a part of all Todd's films, I think, was kind of at an apotheosis in that movie.
Mm-hmm. He often gets accused of his films being too intellectual. But what's really hilarious to me about that is he's the most romantic filmmaker, I think, out there.
Do you think people tend to not see that in his work?
I think they sometimes do. But I feel like in Far From Heaven, for example, that, yes, there was an element of that that's exploring, you know, taking an old, you know, a melodrama, which everybody's familiar with. And the wonderful thing about a melodrama, as Todd kept saying, is you know what's going to happen. You know, it's like that part of the movie is like, you know, you're relaxed for that part because you know, and part of the fun of a melodrama is anticipating, you know, and almost going, oh, you know, almost like, you know, like in those old Freddy horror movies where you just know he's going to come out from around the corner. But at Far From Heaven's heart, it is, you know, a deeply emotional story. It's not an exercise. And I was on an airplane once when it was showing, and it was really amazing to stand at the front and look at all the people watching the movie and how many of them were just crying and crying and crying. Because that's why you go see melodramas, for that release.
We're talking to Christine Vachon, the producer. Her book is A Killer Life. Her company, by the way, is Killer Films. You should talk a little bit about the origin of the name.
You know, we made a little scene killer film called Office Killer that Cindy Sherman directed, that I'm actually extremely fond of. It is a B-horror movie. Cindy Sherman's a well-known photographer. And
a lot of it's very funny, too.
A lot of it is very funny, and it just goes for it. And I produced it with my partner, Pam Koffler, and it was the first movie that we produced together as partners. And the name, because the name of the film was Office Killer, the name of our standalone company, we just decided to call it Killer. And then we thought, what a cool name. We can't let this go. So we held on to it. We did try to option – well, we actually successfully optioned a children's book a few years ago.
So you're actually going to make a family film now?
We would like to, but the woman who owns the estate of the children's book requested that we not option it under the name Killer.
So what are you calling the other company?
Oh, Sunshine or something like that. I mean, just something – you know, she didn't want her – books that are for, you know, 7 to 8 year olds to
be called a killer film. Yeah. But it's funny because in that introduction that I read that John Pearson wrote, he basically sort of likens what you do to that punk period where Stiff Records got the name. And killer actually feels to me like it's kind of an embodiment of punk in some way. Do you feel that that sort of do-it-yourself aesthetic and also that thing we're talking about where point of view and making people maybe a little dislocated is filtered into your work too? You don't talk about much in the book, but I just wonder as a person if you felt that was part of it.
Oh, we absolutely do. But I also think that part of it is just that attitude that when you're trying to get that kind of work out there, you have to have a relentlessness and a fearlessness, an absolute disregard for you know, what people, you know, what are people going to think? What are people going to say? Just a complete and pristine belief in your own vision. That's the only thing that makes us successful.
How do you mean?
I mean, we always have our eyes on the prize. If there's a movie that we're determined to get made, we get it made. And sometimes it's, you know, it's insane obstacles. Sometimes it takes a really long time. I mean, Betty Page, the notorious Betty Page, Mary Harron's last movie.
But you talk about in the book that she, part of the thing that slowed down was she was determined to make it in black and white, but you guys stuck with her on that.
We did stick with her. I mean, listen, I'm not saying I didn't every now and then go, you know, Mary. I'm not saying that I didn't try and have that conversation. And she would just look at me and go, no, no. She just could not imagine that that film could be a genuine articulation of her vision. Without it being, I think it's about 80% in black and white. And we, you know, at the end of the day, that's what we're about.
You talk a lot in the book about something that I think is really fascinating, which is you mentioned in the early 90s when you went to Berlin and you basically thought at one point as being James Shamus' assistant because mm-hmm. there weren't women producers around. And it strikes me as being, or should be so much more of a case in independent film that it would be a place for women to go just because those kinds of stories that the studios don't want to make. Let's look at it this way. So many of the female, the actress performance that get nominated, probably the majority, come from independent mm-hmm. film. Why do you think that your example hasn't sort of attracted, it's attracted more people trying, but why hasn't it led to more success?
You mean in terms of other female producers?
Yeah.
It's gotten a lot better. I mean, in fact,
I know it's a lot better, but still, it's this. I would expect there to be more than there are. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't think you're wrong. It's definitely. I mean, there's a lot of women line producers, and in a way, the line producing is that weird, nebulous area. What a line producer is you know, a budget is. I mean, in the technical sense, a budget is made up of a number of different line items, meaning film costs $5,000 and renting the equipment costs $10,000 or whatever it is. So a line producer is technically responsible for holding the line, being responsible to the budget, trying to, you know, make sure that the film doesn't spend more money than it has. But because, especially on these kind of films, which are such specific visions, the decision to spend money on one thing over another is often a very creative decision. It's not purely financial. Spending more money on a longer schedule, money on a, you know, on a more elaborate set, all those things.
You give the example at the very beginning of the kinds of things you had to do in making mm-hmm. Breath of Far From Heaven, but you talk about that very specifically about how you had to be adaptable mm-hmm. because there are things that he really wanted to do. And learning
Absolutely.
That your star was pregnant as you were shooting, all those kinds of things.
Right. Right. It's all coming back.
I'm sorry. But I'm just thinking that what you have done would have attracted a lot more younger women mm-hmm. to the business to sort of follow your lead a bit.
Well, I think you're right. I do feel like, you know, they're out there and they're, you know, they're definitely in some ways I'm a little out, you know, I'm a little out of touch with the movies, those, you know, $2 million movies or under that people cut their teeth on. Those movies don't come to me anymore.
Is that true?
Well, they shouldn't. They should go to somebody younger and a little hungrier. I mean, there's plenty of do-it-yourselfness, a killer.
Sure.
But we don't have it in us anymore to do those tiny little movies. We're too damn old. I mean, you have to have that, you know, you have to be younger and like caffeine-fueled to make those things happen. In some ways, you're right to bring it back to like the whole notion of punk rock, too. Because that was, you know, that was the time. And in some ways, punk was so inspirational because it really was like, f*** it, I can just, you know, I can do whatever I want. We don't have to be part of the mainstream and we don't care. And that is certainly how we started out. Now, you know, obviously we're a little bit more like, you know what, if we can be part of the mainstream sometimes, that's just great. I can't pretend that going to the Academy Awards with Far From Heaven wasn't a fantastic experience. Of course it was. And, you know, Boys Don't Cry winning, that's you know, that was amazing. But that was not in our heads when we made those movies.
We'll take a break here. My guest is Christine Vachon. Her book is A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. But she survives more of this show. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
Welcome back. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is producer Christine Vachon of Killer Films. Her new book is A Killer Life. I want to talk to you a little bit about what I think must have been a big influence on you as well, which is having that confluence in your house of having a French mother and a father who's a great photographer, John Vachon, who I'm a huge fan of, who got his start shooting pictures for the Farm Security Administration and being financed by the government. So you basically had two different kinds of poles of art in your house, didn't
mm-hmm.
you?
But, you know, my father, interestingly enough, like a lot of photographers of his generation, felt that, you know, he watched photography morph in his lifetime into an art form. And he wasn't sure how he felt about it.
How do you mean?
Well, he, you know, and it's interesting because I'd say that if you know his work, you'd consider him one of the most artistic photographers of the FSA. And at the same time, he really maintained a very, you know, photographers did not print their own work. They didn't supervise the printing of their own work. And he maintained an attitude that was like, you know, there's no mystery to it. You point the camera and you press the button.
And literally thousands of his photographs didn't belong to him. As I told you, I found out about him going to the Library of Congress and buying prints in the late 80s for $25 a piece.
Absolutely. I mean, anybody can do that. And we own very little of his work because it was all made for the government.
Wow.
Really, what we get now sometimes is, like, I'll see he and other photographers used to give each other their work. So when a photographer dies, like Jack Delano, for example, I went to a photography exhibit and saw a number of my father's pictures there. It's like, where did these come from? The guy said, I just bought out Jack Delano's estate. And these were pictures that they'd exchanged.
Gosh. And I feel like just reading the book, you're talking about your sister and your mother who built this place that was kind of a salon for your generation.
Absolutely.
All these things are things that you brought to, because it feels to me like your company, given that your relationships with filmmakers you have, it is in fact a kind of a salon too. You people you want to be in business with, which attracts other kinds of people too. That's the kind of a way you lead your life, that your social life and your professional life have kind of married each other.
Yes, sadly that is true. So, but you know, every year we try and have a party, and we don't always manage to do it every year. But we try to have a party that we just invite our writers and directors to. And it's usually a really great party because they get to meet each other. And there's such a vibrancy and so much cross-pollination. It's really exciting.
It's going to be fascinating, too, because you talk a little bit in the book about One Hour Photo and how weird it was to be with a movie that's provisionally independent but studio financed.
Right.
I mean, that's got to be this sort of thing, too, where now it's so much it's overtaken that, you know, to some extent, independent film is kind of like punk. And it's just sort of like a branding sort of mechanism more than anything else.
Well, it is. I mean, I find that when I'm on panels, for example, at film festivals, and there's always that inevitable question, like what makes a movie independent? And it's such a difficult thing to parse because if you go with the definition that, you know, essentially money, the actual character of the money is what makes a movie independent. There's a lot of movies that would fall out of that category that we'd insist should stay in it. So I kind of feel with this all these, you know, small classics divisions and names like Warner Independent, which is like an oxymoron, you know, what do you mean? Independent from what? Really what those classic divisions mean is make it cheaper. But the other side of that, in their, you know, in their defense, is it's supposed to be make it cheaper and we'll take a bigger risk. That's the other end of the sentence.
Which means they want you, as a friend of mine says, make Batman Begins for $10 million.
Well, your friend's exactly right. You know, there's a million titles we could name and get a big star to be in it for half their rate, you know, or a quarter of their rate.
But you sort of set the example for that by the kinds of films you've done, proven that they're successes. But you really still, at this point, I know you mentioned the book, you have kind of a deal where John Wells sort of helps out with a lot of the finances and stuff, but you essentially don't really have a studio deal. Is that not something that you want?
We had one. We had one with Warner Brothers. We've had a couple. We had one with MGM. And then we had one with Warner Brothers. And right now we do not have one, but I think we will be making one reasonably soon, but not necessarily with a studio, with a you know, another like-minded independent company.
Just a financing source, essentially?
Yeah. You know, I mean, look, the financing has changed. Now most, even studio films, want to offset their risk in some way, either with foreign money or equity money. We've become much more in the business of putting together, you know, or maybe going to a studio with some equity in place, going to a studio with foreign money in place, or both. You know, it's becoming rarer that we do a one-stop shop.
But the kind of films you want to make are still so much about provocation.
Mm-hmm.
That I've got to wonder if you feel that there is a place that you always, to some extent, by virtue of the kinds of films you want to see made, be an outsider.
I don't know. I mean, I guess, look, at the end of the day, I've had a remarkable career, and I wouldn't change any part of it. I feel like now we're sort of entering this new era. I won't even say new era, because I just like the idea of rebirth, because Killers had its 10-year anniversary, and now it's like, well, what does the next 10 years bring? And the fact is, we're at a point now where we can get almost any material we want. We can get almost any potential filmmaker, director, you know, playwright, whoever, to sit down with us, because we are seen as such a bastion of, you know, creative integrity, and that it pays off. That if you stick with the vision and you protect the vision, then you're going to make something successful. Now, I'm not saying that our movies are all like, you know, runaway financial successes. Some of them are, and some, you know, but for the most part, they tend to have been made for the right budgets, you know, and that's, I mean, look, I use Boys Don't Cry as an example because there clearly was a movie to have been made there with a known movie star playing Brandon Tina. And, you know, our financiers were anxious that we wanted to go with an unknown, you know, they let us, and they let us for the right amount of money, but it was a creative decision because it felt so important. Felt so critical that when she walk on screen, the audience have no clue who the hell she was.
It's the truth. My guess is Christine Vachon, founder of Killer Films, and her book is A Killer Life. As we talk about these things, I mean, remember the original title was of Boys Don't Cry was Take Like a Man from the old Cure song. And just having read the book and knowing so much about your work, music plays so big a part in these films. That's why I keep coming back to punk,
mm-hmm.
because that, one way or another, sort of like slices its way through so much of the stuff you've done. Do you sort of see that now in retrospect? Was that always something that you saw? Because the music is also part of the personality of these films, so it's not just a soundtrack slapped on. Obviously, for you, that's key in these films too, isn't it?
Well, I love music movies. I mean, they're so much fun to make in the sense that the music just allows you so much emotional range, you know? I mean, We're shooting Todd Haynes' new Bob Dylan movie right now.
Why don't you talk a little about the struggle getting it made in the book?
Yes, and that struggle continues as we're actually shooting it. But sometimes what Todd will do is he'll know already, you know, he has it all mapped out which Dylan songs are being used where. And sometimes we'll do a take and he'll do one totally clean. And then he'll say, all right, this time I'm going to play the song, you know, because he figures he has the dialogue clean already. So the actor gets to hear, it gets to have a vision of what, you know, months and months and months from now, the whole married thing is going to be, just a little sense of it. And it changes everything.
But going to Sundance, as much as you must and as much I do now, I really see how these movies and I think of that period, that really interesting period, not really interesting, but that early period of Killer where that was, well, all these films and these things we're talking about were starting to come into play. And now I can see how a whole generation of filmmakers are making those kinds of movies now. Mm-hmm. They use that music in that way to sort of explicate a character point or a story point.
Yep. You know, of course. And it's also, I mean, look, now it's like music, you know, with downloading and you know, iPods and MTV. It's like it's.
But, I mean, what you're talking about would tend to be more a commercial, kind of almost a cynical thing. It's incredibly heartfelt in these movies.
Oh, yes.
And I just feel like that's something that to me really marks what Killer does. That the music comes out of that milieu that's very important to the character. You talk about a song in Even in Boys Don't Cry,
mm-hmm.
How Kim Pierce had to work to get the song she really wanted. And that thing, just again, it comes for me out of seeing what Pearson said in that foreword. That feels to me as much a part of Killer and something that's particular to what you do as anything else.
Well, that's great. I mean, I don't disagree, you know. And as I say, the music movies, it's like they take us somewhere else. You know, they really do.
But even going back to when you first connected with Todd Haynes when he made Superstar,
mm-hmm.
I mean, the very first thing. I mean, tell the audience what Superstar is about.
Oh, Superstar is Todd Haynes's probably his most notorious work. Its full title is Superstar, the Karen Carpenter Story. It's been banned. And it tells the story of Karen Carpenter using Barbie dolls, or I should say Barbie-like dolls, because we were almost sued by Mattel. And it's an extraordinary work because when it first begins, you think, wow, this is the best joke ever. Of course you should tell Karen Carpenter's story using these dolls. You know, she was a Barbie doll. By the end of the movie, you can't believe the performance he's getting out of them. And I think it's just a, you know, it's a real, it kind of pulls together all the ways in which Todd is just able to deal with identity and shifting identity. But the biggest surprise, I think, in that movie is a lot of people came out of there like thinking, wow, the Carpenters were actually really good.
And really sort of in that way kind of honest.
Which, absolutely.
Which is that all those things you're talking about in that movie, I think they really inform what you do as a producer.
Absolutely.
And we're out of time. Thank you so much for
joining
us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
My guest again is Christine Vachon. Her book is A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. Our technical director and editor this week at KCRW is Bob Carlson, with assistance from Paul West at Argo Network in New York. Mary Bradley is the producer. I'm going to go see some movies. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.